Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the Sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, this morning we're going to hit the road to visit with a couple of key officials. First, we'll head to our Hartford studios for a wide-ranging chat with Connecticut Governor Dan Malloy. We'll hear about how the state is booting up the governor's Second Chance 2.0 program to reduce prison populations and recidivism. We'll talk about new leadership for Connecticut's problem-plagued Department of Motor Vehicles, a recent travel ban the governor initiated over discriminatory legislation aimed at the LGBT community, and a couple of economic and community development initiatives right here in Connecticut. Then we'll head to New Britain and chat with U.S. Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty. We'll talk about how the Congresswoman is supporting state manufacturers, helping more Connecticut students, particularly young women, learn about and pursue careers in the STEM fields. The work she's doing on national security and potential threats from terrorist organizations like ISIS, and how Congresswoman Esty is increasing efforts to help the state address the opioid epidemic it's facing. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. Speaking of the opioid epidemic, the Connecticut Department of Mental Health and Addiction Services has announced a new toll-free number connecting residents seeking treatment and services for an opioid addiction to local walk-in assessment centers. Residents can call 800-563-4086 24 hours a day to connect them or a loved one to a walk-in assessment center in their area. In addition, callers will be followed up with a phone call by trained staff to determine if they're able to connect to necessary services and problem solve any barriers that might have come in their way. Again, the toll-free number for Connecticut residents is 800-563-4086. That's 800-563-4086. We also want to remind you that the Agency on Aging of South Central Connecticut is looking for individuals who will celebrate their 100th birthday in 2016 or who have already passed that milestone. The agency is hosting a special luncheon May 4th to honor and celebrate the lives of these centenarians. Since 1963, communities across the country have shown their gratitude by celebrating Older Americans Month every May, recognizing older Americans for their contributions, and demonstrates our nation's commitment to help them stay healthy and active. To request an invitation for a centenarian you know, please visit AOASCC.org. That's AOASCC.org for the Agency on Aging of South Central Connecticut. Well, I guess when most of my media colleagues think about Governor Daniel Malloy these days, they see a pie chart that's almost completely filled with state budget and legislative concerns. But we want to explore the many things that fit into what a lot of other reporters might see as a tiny little slice of that pie chart. So we hope the governor is happy to hear that the award-winning For the People is adopting a credo of information, not confrontation. And with that in mind, we're going to touch on a number of subjects today that will hopefully have a great and positive impact on the state and its residents far into the future. Governor, Second Chance Society is at the top of your agenda today. You were just came in from Enfield. Let's talk a little bit about that announcement you're making as we record today.
Well, today we formally marked the opening of a center at one of our prisons exclusively for people who have been convicted of DUI. Now, to be in jail for DUI almost always means it's not your first time. These are folks who have evidenced addiction problems or reuse or relapse problems. And rather than simply park people in prison for long periods of time, what we've decided to do is we'll incarcerate, but we want to have the services that are designed to help people be successful, to recognize their own weaknesses. Some of these folks have mental illness. Some of these folks have actually been sober for years, ignored the signs of a potential lapse, and then ended up lapsing. So, you know, we have a lot of work to do. It's 118 beds exclusively devoted to this. Now, it also builds on another program, which is we would rather folks be in the community getting the services they need, holding down jobs, supporting their families, keeping their families intact. And working with Mothers Against Drunk Driving, we've done some amazing things in Connecticut. We have 70 folks who are homebound. That is, that they can go to work, but then they have to be home by a certain time. They have to, if their driving privileges are restored, they have to have a breathalyzer ignition system in their cars. So really what this is designed is to lower recidivism. We don't want people coming back to prison. Right. We want them to learn their lesson, to accept the punishment that's been given them, and then go on and live successful lives. And it really is part of the overall Second Chance Society program, which I began not just last year. Really, if you think about our decriminalizing marijuana, I'm not a proponent of legal marijuana, but we decriminalized marijuana. That took 8,000 arrests out of our court system, making that system far more efficient than it's been in decades, but also avoiding that kind of first step to a criminal record. If we can get young people through their formative years without a criminal record, we know statistically that they're far more likely to be successful in life, to get a good job, to get decent housing, to get a student loan if they need it. So a lot of what we're doing in Second Chance Society is avoiding that high school to prison pipeline, that high school to 23 years old, 24 years old, when, by the way, most people mature out of doing stupid things. Most people listening did something stupid between the age of 18 and 21.
And you don't want to put them in a place where they build a foundation that's going to take them in the wrong direction for the rest of time.
I don't want to give people advanced degrees in right. criminal behavior, which for young people is what prison is. So we're spending a lot of time and effort on permanent reform as opposed to permanent punishment. And on this youth thing, listen, we know young people don't have the best judgment abilities. Let's be honest.
They're built that way.
Yeah, well, they're built that way. But, I mean, listen, as a society, we won't sell liquor to people under the age of 21 because we don't think that they have the skill set necessary to manage that. And yet our criminal justice system treats anybody over the age 18 as an adult. It doesn't make a lot of sense. Let's try to put as much time and effort into correcting problems, into getting services, and having people end up not with a criminal record, which will scar them for the rest of their lives.
Okay. You did mention the marijuana issue, and that's a conversation that's been coming up in my world more and more. Looking at a fix looking for a revenue fix, that is still something that is either off the table or far down the road.
Yeah, I'm not a supporter. I think that I think medical marijuana makes sense. I don't think marijuana, a simple possession, should be a crime. On the other hand, I don't think it should be a moneymaker for government, and I think we should do everything we can to discourage its use by folks who are not using it for medicinal purposes. Mm-hmm. There's precious little good coming out of marijuana, quite frankly, except in the medical field.
Okay. That's for you if you need.
Oh, thank
also.
You.
We wanted to give you a chance to also talk about the report on national crime punishment rates by the Pew Trust, which you also were highlighting a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah, well, again, our prison population is 23% smaller than it was just a few years ago, and yet we're enjoying the safest, lowest crime rate in 48 years. We've put more time and effort into, again, going back to reforming folks. The prison I just visited earlier today, this is the third specialized unit to get ready to help get prisoners ready to go back mm-hmm. to society. One was kind of general catch-all. If you're nearing the end of your sentence, we're gonna give you a more intense experience around getting ready to go back. The next unit was for people who were part of the military at some point before they became part of our prison population. What we're really trying to do there is have them recall and relive the best days of their lives when they were disciplined, when they had the skill set necessary to be successful. The third one was the DUI program to get people ready to go back to community. And last month I also visited our first women's center around getting that population ready to go back to the community. What Pew is saying is, hey, listen, this is the right direction to go, and Connecticut's leading.
Great. When we first talked a little over a year ago promoting the Second Chance Society, we got a lot of information, but a lot has happened since then, including a rebranding of it to the Second Chance 2.0 bill.
Yeah.
What are some of the key components of the rebranding?
The new legislative effort is around a couple of things. Number one is bail reform. We have about 550 people in jail awaiting trial at any given time. On bail, that's less than $20,000. Now, you can normally make $20,000, that number under $20,000, you can make that anywhere from about $250 to about $2,000, mm-hmm. which means we have a lot of people in jail simply because they're poor, who wouldn't otherwise be there. So we have a series of reforms around that issue. And by the way, if you truly are conservative, understand this, that every time we have somebody in jail, it costs us about $120 to $150 a night. So having 550 people in jail awaiting trial because they're poor is very expensive for us. Basically, two nights of incarceration is what it would cost us as opposed to that $250 that they could otherwise get out on bail for.
A week's pay for me as a journalist.
Hey, listen, I got you. So a lot of it is around bail reform to make sure that people are not being held because they're poor. But another situation that I should address is that we've done the studies. In periods of incarceration awaiting trial for as little as 8 to 14 days have a predictive factor of about 56% that those folks will not get to court, will have another crime, will 56% greater after as little as 8 to 14 days. Hmm. Why? Because 8 to 14 days cost you your job, may cost you your place where you live, may cost you your familial relationships. These folks basically get out after 8 to 14 days of incarceration and have nowhere to go and no job to go back to.
Their life may be over as they know it.
Well, you know, it certainly substantially changed. Yeah. So avoiding those periods of incarceration simply because somebody's poor is very important. Another major part is to let's look at the ages that we're holding people responsible for. If a kid who was 17 in high school hits a kid who's 18 in high school, and the kid who's 18 hits back, and they both get arrested for assault, right? The kid who's 18 can end up with a criminal record. Mm. The kid who's 17 can't. Does that make a lot of sense?
Mm. You know, it's not even publicized. It
right.
can't be in the paper,
right.
even.
For the 17,
internet and all
so,
that.
So what I'm saying is let's examine those propositions. Let's extend juvenile treatment for certain crimes, low-level, misdemeanor, nonviolent, or at least nothing more than a simple assault to people who are 18 years old. Let's prevent them from having that that criminal record before they get out of high school.
Right.
So we're looking at the age of holding people accountable and what level of accountability they should hold. And we want to extend the programs that we have for people who are under the age of 18 to people who are over the age of 18, all the way up eventually to the age of 21 or their 21st birthday.
Okay.
So these are major components of this year's effort.
Great. Let's switch gears to state services and something that so many folks have to experience or some say endure every once in a while, and that is the visit to the DMV.
Yeah.
You've been very proactive in promoting the expansion of services through agencies like AAA to take a little bit of the pressure off. I have personally had wonderful experiences in getting the services that I could through AAA. And you also have new leadership.
Yeah, we do. We have a new commissioner and deputy commissioner who are quite the team. But let me go back to this thing about AAA.
Yeah.
So we have a contract in place that allows AAA to perform many functions. Now, AAA is basically an insurance agency, so let's understand that. What I've said is, hey, let's expand that to other insurance agencies. Let's allow people to do a lot of transactions with their insurance agent or with their car dealer that they would otherwise have to directly interact with the Department of Motor Vehicles about. That way we shorten the lines at those other facilities. When you're buying a car, you should be able to get it registered. You should be able to perhaps even renew your license. You should be able to process your insurance. You should be able to get all of that stuff done. And all dealers should be in a position to do that, at least over a certain size. And that's true of insurance agencies. Right now, are most recently, about 40% of the transactions that people were going to DMV for could actually be done from their home. We need to re-educate people to use their computer system or their access to computer system or their phone, for that matter, to do that transaction and keep people out of the lines. The other thing I've said is, hey, listen, we've turned the DMV into a bill collector. You know, if you have 39 cents overdue on your car tax, we stop the transaction after we've started. We discover that. We tell you have to leave. You have to go straighten that out. Then you have to come back, wait in line, make the line longer, and then restart the transaction.
Yeah, and the frustration factor.
And the frustration factor. And what I'm saying is, hey, listen, we shouldn't be a bill collector. But if you're going to make us a bill collector, don't make us stop a transaction for, you know, so few number of dollars. We're punishing everyone behind you in the line because you failed to pay a parking ticket. Mm-hmm. You know, again, should we be collecting a debt of $25, stopping the transaction, making you leave and making you come back, stand in line and take someone else's place? Mm-hmm. I think we need to come up with a reasonable, if we're going to continue to do that service for local governments, it shouldn't start at $1. It should have a reasonable start amount. Maybe it's $300. Maybe mm-hmm. it's $200. But we should get out of the business of being a debt collector.
And where are you in the process of trying to make that happen?
Both things that I've just talked about with respect to expanding the number of outside agencies that could help you perform your transaction is before the legislature, as is my desire to get out of the bill collecting, or at least set an appropriate level where we're collecting the bills. I just don't think we should punish everybody because somebody, you know, may have paid their tax bill a day late, and therefore there's $2.50 owed in interest, and we stop the transaction dead in its tracks and send the person away to go do two or three other steps before they come back, get back in line. It doesn't make sense.
Excellent. April is Sexual Assault Awareness Month, so it's astute timing that Governor Malloy has appointed a new working group aimed at examining and limiting barriers for submitting sexual assault evidence at the Connecticut Forensic Science Laboratory. This is something that nobody thinks about unless they're a victim or you're in law enforcement or involved with the judicial process. Why is this important?
Well, my wife and I have been involved in the issue of sexual assault, particularly for most of our adult life. My wife ran a sexual assault agency for 11 years before we moved up to Hartford to take my new job, and she's not in that field directly anymore. But just yesterday, she gave a speech at Yale. She speaks on the issue within the state and on a national basis on a regular basis. This is a very important issue to Kathy and I. Mm-hmm. There was a tremendous backlog of untested kits. We're catching up in that, and we're doing that rapidly. We want to make it easier to prosecute sexual crimes, to have the best evidence to hold people accountable for sexual crimes. That includes the folks who would entice young people, young women into being or forcing them into prostitution. This is across the board issue of great importance to us in Connecticut. Too many young women and a larger number of young boys and men will be the victim of sexual assault. We've got to do everything in our power to stop it. We have had groups work on this issue. We've convened a new group to say, all right, what are other best practices available in the prosecution of sexual crimes that other states are doing that we're not yet doing in Connecticut, and we're taking a look at it.
As you interact and network with other governors and travel around the country, have you seen a model in any other state or a jurisdiction that is working to the level that you'd like to see Connecticut doing the same?
Well, some of the, you know, we have our criminal justice system is less centralized, or our prosecution system is less centralized than some other states. And I think as a result, there's been a slower spread within that system of what is cutting edge. For instance, and I would say that because of inattentiveness on the state government's part, I'll go back to this issue. We weren't doing enough of the checking of the kits so that we can match crimes that may have been perpetrated by the same person. And that may, you know, when you can do that, that leads to a higher degree of prosecution. So, yes, there are good practices out there that we need to bring to our state, and then we need to make sure that every police department, every prosecutor, every hospital, every kit collector is aware of the best way to conduct themselves in these investigations, and that's what our goal is to do.
Yours advocacy on behalf of the LGBT community is renowned. And a couple of days ahead of our visit this morning, you signed an executive order banning state-funded travel to North Carolina in response to a recently adopted piece of legislation down there. Tell me a little bit about that.
You know, North Carolina, the people of North Carolina are good people, I think. I think they have been badly led. They enacted legislation that is discriminatory and is intended to be discriminatory against gay, lesbian, and transgender individuals. That's the intent. And this particular legislation went so far as to say that local communities cannot pass their own laws with respect to protecting these individuals. It has to be done on a state basis. So a place like Charlotte or Raleigh that may have had a far more progressive legislation, particularly protecting the rights of transgender individuals, basically got blown out of the water. And I looked at this thing, and basically what this says is a person who is a transgender individual and may be undergoing medical treatments to affect that change from from male to female or otherwise, that they have to use the bathroom that aligns with the sex on their birth certificate as opposed to their identity and their and what they are transitioning to. And quite frankly, that think of how dangerous that is. So that someone who's transitioning from one sex to another is forced in their garb, in their dress, in their appearance to go into something that doesn't align with their transitioning gender. It's dangerous. We protect the rights of people in our state. North Carolina isn't going to do it. Now, this is a point. We protect them in Connecticut. We have transgender people who work in state government in Connecticut. I can't send folks to a state where they're going to be endangered. And I'm not going to send other folks to that state while our transgender community working for us or participating in our programs and our collegiate level will be discriminated against. And so sometimes you just have to stand up and say, we're not going to take this anymore.
And this is not the first time you've, in fact, affected a travel ban.
I affected a travel ban about a year ago in India when Indiana passed even worse legislation, basically legalizing all forms of discrimination if it's religious-based towards any gay, lesbian, or transgender individual. Interestingly enough, that legislation got undone in about 10 days' time. When you know, we were the first state to announce that we were going to have a travel ban. Indianapolis in particular, gigantic community for conventions, for meetings, for gatherings. Charlotte, gigantic community. Thousands and thousands of hotel rooms that are based on attracting people there for training purposes, for convention purposes, and the like. It's incumbent upon those of us who believe in protecting our citizenry from discrimination to respond when locations, states, entities are going to legalize discrimination against our citizens.
Great. We've got a couple more minutes with Governor Daniel Malloy. Let's turn to economic development and two more points, and we'll send him off to Meriden. On the subject of economic development, you announced that Connecticut will be the latest state participating in the Federal Reserve Bank of Boston's Working Cities Challenge competition. This is an economic development effort building cross-sector collaboration and leadership instead of just trying to throw money at economic development. It's kind of an innovative kind of flipping the initiative upside down.
It's a test of the community, to tell you the truth. What this program is in essence is And by the way, you're very well informed. Most people wouldn't even know about that program. But what we're going to do is we're going to say to a series of communities, give us your plan. You've got to show that you have everybody at the table, that you're working on a plan of revitalization, that it makes sense, that you have, you know, if you have a zoning board, the zoning board's on, you have planning board, the planning board's on, you have the community in place, you have the political leadership to execute that, which you're saying. Help people do that and put them into competition for grants to further their plan. It's worked extremely well in Massachusetts. The Federal Reserve Bank approached me about a year ago. We went through a vetting process. I'm all for this, and we're going to begin that process in Connecticut. We've identified a bunch of communities who were making eligible for this first round, and I want to stress it's just the first round. Mm-hmm. But what we have found, and I certainly found that during the 14 years that I was mayor of Stamford, that when you have a community-wide process where there's real buy-in, where you've resolved the issues before you try to bring in a level of development or a particular project, that project is far more likely to be successful. So we want to incentivize communities to do just that.
And this is not necessarily a winning grant that would go toward expanding or establishing a business.
No. This is about a community effort. Should we change the size of our roads? Are they too wide? Are they too narrow? How do we have a better business district? Should we build an area or encourage social service providers? I mean, there's all kinds of ideas. Mm-hmm. Would a beautification project or uniting neighbors, joining neighborhoods to one another by taking certain steps and making certain
community gardens and things
gardens, pathways, walkways. How do we tie communities together? How do we incentivize people making private investments in pursuit of a community plan?
Great. Well, I can't wait to hear more about that as the program rolls out in Connecticut. Last but not least, a friend of yours, a friend of mine, a friend of our radio stations, and a great friend of Connecticut, who is really somebody I look at as kind of a business diplomat who has shown a lot of other states what great things we have in Connecticut, Bob Kaufman.
Yes.
You were up in Manchester the other day announcing an expansion of Bob's Furniture.
Yeah, you know, Bob's, I was joking with him, you know, we had the live Bob, and I was asking him, should we like...
Where's the claymation?
Do we want the claymation, do we want the cartoon, or do we want the real one? Yeah. But, you know, Bob's Discount Furniture is a great Connecticut story. He started 25 years ago, now has over 60 outlets, is one of the largest furniture retailers, one of the top 20 in the country. They're going to build a new building. They're going to enlarge their corporate staff by 125 positions. That's going to happen in Connecticut versus Massachusetts, which is another location they looked at simply because they hired a guy from Massachusetts who is running the company now. We didn't want it to go, and we're incentivizing them staying in Manchester, building that 106,000 square foot building and adding the 125 jobs here in Connecticut. And we're very proud of it.
Excellent. Well, that's all on my agenda, but in the last couple minutes that we have together, I'll give you the last word, keeping in mind that the program's going to air in about eight or 9 days from the time we record it. Anything you'd like to impart on the listeners across the state of Connecticut say goodbye?
I will. I'll say, you know, you talked about the pie chart in the beginning. I think sometimes that too much is made of where we are budgetarily as opposed to the investments we're making. And I think that Connecticut needs to make investments in itself. We're suffering because we underinvested in transportation. One of our biggest drives is to undo that harm that's been done. A report recently came out that said Connecticut ranks 10th worst in bridge maintenance and the age of our bridges and their ability to do the job that they need to do. That's because we underinvested in transportation for 40 years. So we've laid out a plan of proper investment for the next 30 years to undo the damage of the last 40 and, quite frankly, to make us best in class in New England and the region.
I mean, we stood together with Commissioner Redeker and Danbury about 7 or 8 months ago.
Right. And by the way, a little bit further up 84 in Waterbury is that we're undertaking. That in a years of 1 year of construction, we're 10 months ahead of the total project timeline, which goes out a couple of years, and it's under budget. We can do these things. We've got to widen 84 where it goes from three lanes to two lanes to three lanes because, you know, accordions are great instruments, but they're not good highways.
Right.
And so we have to – but what I'm saying to the public and what I'm saying to the legislature is we need a constitutional lockbox so that all of our population knows that every single dollar that's raised for transportation will only be spent on transportation, on those bridges, on those bus systems, on our airport, on our highway system. We need a first-class transportation system if we're going to compete with states that have invested. Massachusetts, massive investments in transportation over the last 4 years. New York, I mean 40 years. New York City, New York State, massive investment. Just down in New Jersey, they built a parallel highway system. They took a system from three lanes to six lanes by building a parallel system. No one even noticed. While we were doing practically nothing, we've got to modernize transportation, including our rail system here in Connecticut. And by the way, the rail system will be the first system to actually be modernized because we control the system. We have the rights of way. We know what we have to do. I want to cut 15 minutes off of a trip from New Haven to New York City. I want to cut 7-8 minutes from a place like Stamford. Let's get our workforce from New York City. Let's send our workforce to New York City. Let's do it in a speedy time on a system that you can rely on. Okay. That's true to get up to Waterbury. I want to have that system in place. It's true what we should do between Danbury and Metro North. Let's modernize that system.
Great. Let's get you back on the transportation system. Governor Daniel Malloy visiting with us today. Hope to have you back soon. Thank you so much, Governor.
Thank you.
Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through Love CT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to Love CT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Did you ever think you could be a hero? Well, Griffin Hospital's Valley Parish nurses are encouraging individuals to be a hero for their friends and family in 2016 by offering free CPR training throughout the year. Family and Friends CPR is a non-certifying course that teaches the basics of adult and child CPR and how to save a person if they're choking. They even offer training for infant care. This course is offered on the third Saturday of every month from 10 to noon all through 2016, but registration is required and space is limited. If you'd like to find out more, call 203-732-1337 to sign up, or for more information, go to griffinhealth.org. And here's an announcement for all you vets and those who love and support them. Please come out and join me this morning at Guilford VFW Post 7666, 11th Annual Run for Veterans. This is a 5K and 10K run or 2 mile health walk, stepping off from Fireman's Field right behind Bishop's Orchard and Market at 10 a.m. Registration is open from 8:30 to 9:45. So come out and run or walk to help Guilford VFW, supporting vets and their families along Connecticut's shoreline for years. For details or directions, visit guilfordvfw.com or just come on out today for the 10 a.m. Run for Veterans at Fireman's Field, just off Route 1 by Bishop's Orchard. I'll see you there.
Well, I'm very pleased and honored to be here in New Britain. With Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty of the 5th District, my congresswoman. I always mention to her that I am on the last reaches, the very edge of the 5th District. And
Where exactly are you?
On Highland Avenue on corner of Chipman Street. So I guess Washington Avenue is Congresswoman DeLauro's district.
So. Yeah, we're right at that edge there.
So I can bring you two together and you could like do a water balloon fight across the street or something. That would be really interesting. But lots to talk about in the few minutes that we have with the congresswoman this this morning. So let's start with talking about the junkets of meetings that you're in the middle of. This is going to be broadcasting after your last kind of town meeting situation, sure. But you'd already been in my hometown of Waterbury, and that's a big manufacturing town built on manufacturing, the Brass City. So let's first talk about your visit to Waterbury and some of the things you talked about, and let's segue into the great advocacy and work you're doing on behalf of Connecticut manufacturers.
Well, thanks, John. It's great to be with you. And sure, let's talk about, I'm holding three town halls over this next week. The first one was 2 days ago, was on Monday, in the not best weather we've ever had in April in Waterbury, but we still had a hearty group of folks who turned out to talk about, you know, what are the challenges and opportunities that we're facing as a country and as a state. And so we did talk about a number of the issues you and I are going to be talking about today, about job opportunities, about the threat of ISIS, about education for all our children, you know, a number of the same issues that we're looking at. So Waterbury is a perfect place to talk about manufacturing. And actually, we're sitting here in the hardware city in New Britain. So really, the 5th District of Connecticut, from Danbury up to Torrington, all the way through the Naugatuck Valley, Waterbury, New Britain, Meriden, have this strong, proud tradition of manufacturing. Mm-hmm. And I really see that as a core base for rebuilding our economy, both for Connecticut and for the future. You know, we can add high-value-added jobs, and I am in manufacturing facilities all the time. I was actually at one yesterday, BD up in Canaan, tucked away in the northwest corner. They make 2.7 billion, that's with a B, billion syringes a year. The vast majority of syringes made and used in America are made right here in Connecticut in this tiny little facility that's tucked away, 400 people using cutting-edge technology to sterilize, to fabricate and to sterilize our syringes. So, you know, there's all kinds of interesting things being done in the state and great opportunity and jobs that are open right now. When I drove up yesterday, they had a sign, hiring now. And our manufacturers are hiring.
Yeah, a lot of signs like that.
A lot of signs like that. So I see this as a huge opportunity for people who live in our state to get the skills, whether it's young people just coming out of school or trying to get ready for that first job, or whether it's folks whose jobs have, you know, migrated, disappeared, downsized, that with some retraining, in some cases not that much, it's possible to get a great job leading to a great career, middle class lifestyle. And I'm excited about those prospects I see.
And you have the incredible synergy between the Connecticut Technical College systems, who are now mostly geared up and equipped for 21st century education, segueing into the Connecticut Community College system, which is bolstering its manufacturing initiatives. And the fact that we both share a great passion for supporting Connecticut manufacturing leads me to mention that, in fact, a lot of these companies are a fraction of the size of the factories of our childhood in the industrial cities. But these boutique manufacturers, in some cases, can almost match the financial output and the opportunities that the former manufacturers did in terms of, you know, bringing value to the communities and the employees that they have.
Absolutely. So we're seeing extremely high productivity, which is to say each person working is producing a whole lot more product. And that's really the way forward for our state. It's high-value workers producing high-value products and services. And that's how we're going to be competitive in the world. You know, we've got a world economy at this point, globalized economy. The U.S. is only 5% of the population. So I put my money on American workers, American ingenuity, American products. And if we can sell to the 95% of the rest of the world, those are huge, you know, huge markets for us. And Connecticut's actually a really export-oriented state. A lot of our sales and a lot of our product and a lot of our income in this state actually comes from sales not just outside of Connecticut, but actually the rest of the world. So you see that in aerospace, you see that in biotech, biomedical devices. So those are continue to be growth areas for us. And I want to strengthen that partnership between the technical high schools, which are the best in the country, our community colleges and our universities, both private and public. And they're great opportunities to do that. That's in part, like, one of the pieces of legislation I'm working on right now that I've introduced is the Manufacturing Universities Act. And that would have grant money available to universities like UConn's great engineering program to really strengthen through grant programs an even tighter connection between our universities and the manufacturers in their area. And I think that's vitally important for us. This is something I've learned over my 3 years in Congress about those synergies, those interconnections. They're there for the taking. We don't always make as good use of them as we can. And I want to fill all those 18,000 open jobs for manufacturing in New England right now, and a lot of them right here in the state. So those are great jobs. They pay well, and I want to make sure we've got that pipeline of workers for the future.
You're also a highly recognized proponent of STEM education programs and where they can take the next generation of American workers. Tell me what you're working on in terms of supporting and growing both the opportunities for individuals, particularly young women, to go into STEM careers and where they will go after that education is with them.
Sure. Well, STEM, as everybody, I think, is beginning to learn now, is the science, technology, engineering, and math. And to that, we really need to highlight computer science skills, so coding and other computer literacy and competency. And most of the jobs of the future require some of that, whatever the job may be. You know, writers are writing on computers. People in healthcare are using computers to track medication, et cetera. So a lot of jobs require computer skills now. So I've been very successful in working with Democrats and Republicans in Congress, and I've passed two bills on STEM education. One signed into law. That was with conservative Texan Republican Lamar Smith, who's chairman of the Science Committee that I serve on, and he and I and another member of Congress put together a bill to support computer science education and to help strengthen and support master teachers in the STEM fields. One of the things we've learned is how critical an inspiring teacher can be, but it's tough. You know, the private sector is competing for these same people who are great teachers to go into the private sector. They may make a lot more money there. So I really want to work with our teachers to help them be engaging, inspiring teachers for the next generation. So that's been part of my focus. So that bill was signed into law last year. And another one passed just 2 weeks ago, also on STEM and entrepreneurship for women. I'm going to be meeting with a group of women tonight. There's a celebratory dinner recognizing the advancement of women in the STEM field. So this is a critical part of the workforce. You can't have half the workforce not be involved in STEM. Right. We're not going to be able to fill the jobs. And frankly, we won't get the insights and the discoveries and the invention and the opportunity to really build on our diverse country and a diverse world. So I see it as a multiple win. You know, we get more people hired for these jobs, and we get new products, new services, different perspective for a young woman coming out of Waterbury than you might for a young man coming out of Simsbury. Their life experience is different, and they may see different problems and different opportunities that they can use these STEM powers to solve. So I'm excited about those prospects.
Excellent. Thank you. If you don't recognize the voice, we are with Congresswoman Elizabeth Esty this morning for just a few more minutes, but still lots to talk about. A couple of serious subjects. We were fortunate to have Senator Chris Murphy on a few weeks back, and he began a conversation that I'd like to continue with you and perhaps Senator Blumenthal and some other lawmakers going down the road, and that is getting your take on the ISIS threat and national security. A lot of people are hearing a lot of things out there on the news, on the campaign trail. I think there may be, as Senator Murphy pointed out, a little bit of confusion, a little bit of misunderstanding. Let's get your take on how secure America really is from your perspective and the ISIS threat.
Well, ISIS clearly poses a threat to America, to our allies in Europe and around the world, and certainly very destabilizing in the Middle East, which has its own implications for other countries, other groups that have already have declared intention of harming the United States. I was had the opportunity to go with three other members of Congress, two Republicans and two of us Democrats, went to Afghanistan and Kuwait in January of this year, so 2 months ago. And it gave me a chance to sort of see on the ground what is happening in Afghanistan, what kind of progress are we making, but also in Kuwait, which is really our staging ground for our efforts in both Iraq and Syria. We have 19,000 U.S. troops in Kuwait now. It's our fourth largest out of the United States concentration of U.S. troops. So it was a chance to really drill down and ask not just generals, but actually the guys on the ground, including a number of them from Connecticut who I met with. And so there was some good news out of that, which is that in Afghanistan, progress is being made, and the Afghan people really want to and are showing increasing capability to defend their own borders, to push out Al-Qaeda, Taliban, and ISIS, who are all, you know, have various footholds in the region. That's really important. Because remember, we got involved in Afghanistan, you know, 15 years ago as a response to, you know, Al-Qaeda using that as a safe haven. So we need to deny
the goal
them.
Of equipping them.
Absolutely.
To hold their own.
Exactly. So our mission there to equip and train and support them is really important. And since the Afghanis are showing a willingness to do that, to my mind, that's critical. The U.S. has got to be supporting people, but only supporting people who really want and are going to profit from that support to pushing back. Now, I think it's really important in light of what we've seen with these terrible attacks in Brussels just a couple of weeks ago to understand, you know, what is going on in Europe and what's going on in the United States. We have superb counterterrorism efforts and intelligence here in the United States. We're protected by these oceans in ways that really give us a significant advantage over what's happening in Europe. Mm-hmm. One of my big takeaways from what we see what happened in Brussels is Europe has a lot of work to do about sharing information with each other. Turkey had reported information to Belgium. Belgium didn't act on it. Mm. That's deeply concerning, not just for the Belgians, but that's concerning to me and the Congress and should be to Americans because we have what's called a visa waiver program. Now, this is a program that our friends and allies around the world, if you hold a passport from the UK or from Belgium or from France or Italy, you can come to the United States and visit. There are over 20 million people who do that every year. Now, we've done this for years and years because these are our friends and allies. We trust that they're going to return home. They've got a return plane ticket. Hmm. But the situation's a little different now. We have thousands of first and second, mostly second generation folks in the Middle East who have gotten radicalized or may even just be criminals now who have decided ISIS gives them an excuse to be violent and to be criminals and to be mass murderers if that's what they choose. Mm. It's become a flag of convenience for some of them. They're getting trained in Syria and coming back. They're still holding passports from the European Union, and that permits them to come into the United States without a waiver. We've got to really look at that program. I was one of the people who co-sponsored, not just voted for, but co-sponsored legislation to tighten up that program, to really take a deep dive and look to see, are we being strict enough about that? And I think the new revelations on these, what we found, what happened in Brussels, may require us to go back around again and say, can we have this program in its form now? Do we need to do something different? And, of course, support our allies in Europe to do a better job. But, you know, my first responsibility is to the United States, keeping people safe here at home. That is my number one priority and will continue to be. How do we do this in a way that helps our European allies, help stabilize the Middle East so that the fight is there, not here? Mm. But certainly keeping folks from coming to the United States to perpetrate these attacks is high on the list, and we've got to look at that program and see if that's tight enough.
Okay. Another extremely serious subject in the last couple minutes that we have with you, Congresswoman Esty. Southeastern Connecticut has been getting an inordinate amount of attention over the opioid epidemic and heroin issues and the 415 overdose deaths that Connecticut has experienced just last year, a highly escalating number on a yearly basis. But you know and I
I know that this is not a southeastern Connecticut issue. It appears to be as bad, if perhaps not worse, in areas where we see the predominant victims of these overdoses being young men, 17 to 25, coming from predominantly middle class, mm-hmm. upper middle class, and affluent families. So certainly it is it's an issue shared by many of your constituents and folks across Connecticut. You have seen this problem coming early on. You've been working really hard at the federal level, as well as interacting with agencies and individuals here in Connecticut. What's for the last word for our interview today? What do you want folks to know about the work that's being done at the federal level that's going to try to address and hopefully turn the tide on this opioid epidemic?
Well, it's a tragedy, but it is not a tragedy like an act of God or a tsunami. This is one that we as human beings have control over and we can do something about. I first got interested in this issue when I was on the town council in Cheshire mm-hmm. back in 06, 07, 08, and I saw the prescription drug abuse issue in my community and in surrounding communities. So I started working actually with Newtown's representative at the time, Chris Liddy. And Chris Liddy and I worked on legislation to try to deal with the prescription drug abuse issue and to try to get prescription drugs out of people's medicine cabinets and destroy them so that they aren't there as a temptation, that they aren't there to be stolen, to be experimented with by our teenage kids. That remains an issue. That remains an issue. And we are making some progress. The state's been helping to lead on that. I just had a workshop with folks was part of a workshop and discussion in Wolcott just a couple of days ago. And I'm hearing from everyone that the consequences are devastating, number one. It can happen to anyone. And if you think it can't happen to your kid or your community, sadly, you are wrong. Because this is a scourge that touches everybody. So a lot of my focus right now has, in addition to helping families who are having real challenges, and that includes we get calls in the office and we try to find beds and placement for people, fighting with insurance companies to make sure that they cover the kind of treatment that people want and need. But I am certain now that if we don't deal with prevention, we'll never get ahead of this. And so I introduced legislation a couple of weeks ago, the PREVENT Act in Washington, bipartisan legislation, got a couple of Republicans, Steve Knight from California and Ryan Costello from Pennsylvania, who joined me. And this is legislation, some pieces of which were passed in the Senate bill last month. For public education campaign to really get people to understand just in the way we needed to be educated about the dangers of smoking. People need to understand the risks with prescription drugs that are very powerful, So we should be using them. Don't use them if you don't have to. And be careful about how long you use them. And really work with your physician to understand if you need to actually use them at all. Part of my bill would also have anybody who prescribes narcotics, who has to get what's called a DEA license to prescribe, that anyone who does that, physician, physician assistant, whoever, has to go through continuing medical education on the risks of opioid addiction, 12 hours every 3 years. Now, that's part of there are much bigger requirements for continuing medical education. But given how this has become a public health crisis, I think it's important for anyone who's prescribing to be aware of the consequences and what they can do for alternatives. We're seeing the Centers for Disease Control just came out with some new recommendations about prescribing practices. There are 50 of us, Democrats and Republicans, in the House of Representatives who have formed a bipartisan opioid addiction caucus. We've been holding our own hearings, set up basically our own special task force because of what a big issue it is. And I'm one of the co-chairs of the New England task force to work on this. It is a huge and important issue. I don't want any other family to go through the pain of losing a loved one. And it's young women as well as young men. It's women in their 50s, guys who have been working on the job and gotten injured back and then get addicted to the pain pills. It's veterans coming home who have scars visible and not visible that they're trying to treat. So this needs to be a joint effort in which do not shame, do not blame, but get educated, work with your physicians, and call my office. If you're having issues, please allow us to try to help you, because this is not something that we should be blaming families for bad parenthood, blaming kids for being bad kids, blaming doctors. We just need to fix it. And as with many other issues, I find when you bring people to the table together, everyone agrees that there's a problem here we need to address. We get much better solutions when everybody's working together, right, not blaming, but instead working together to figure out how we can help solve it. And I'm hopeful that we can get this legislation passed, my bill, as well as the Senate bill passed in the House, and get this signed into law to be out there helping people right away.
Excellent. Well, we appreciate you working together with the award-winning For the People. I really appreciate the opportunity to visit with you this morning in New Britain. Congresswoman Elizabeth Estey with us this morning, and we hope to talk to her again soon. Thank you, Congresswoman.
Great. Thanks so much, John. Great to be with you.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and don't necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audience and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.vocat, V as in Victor, O-K-E-T, at connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file, reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve, can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 440 Wheelers Farms Road in Milford. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott, with original music by Noel Viette. This is John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab on our station's website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits, with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.